Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Vetter versus Camwall Electric Cooperative. For the appellant, Camwall Electric Cooperative, we have Mr. Richard Casey, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Mr. Vetter, we have Thomas Clayton, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Justice Sabres has disqualified himself from participating in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert Miller, former justice of this court, now retired, to sit in his place. Mr. Casey, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. The controlling contract in this case, the collective bargaining agreement, vests in the employer the exclusive right to, among other things, discharge employees for cause, as long as such right is not exercised arbitrarily or unfairly. On July 19, 2002, Camwall's general manager walks into the office of Camwall shortly after 5 o'clock, and he sees two of his linemen sitting there with open beers in front of them. And this was almost a half an hour before he believes that they are to go off the clock. These are the only two linemen that are available for Camwall to take care of the electricity on Camwall's system. So the following Monday, 3 days later, Mr. Bond checks the time clocks, verifies that these two linemen were still indeed on the clock, that they had not clocked off and gone off duty. And he summoned Mr. Von Wald, the Camwall's attorney, to help him conduct an investigation, which consisted of interviews by Mr. Bond and Mr. Von Wald of Mr. Vetter and Sean Schmidt, the other lineman that was caught with the beer. After conducting that investigation, they determined that, in fact, things were as they seemed to be when Mr. Bond walked in on his lineman that Friday, that, in fact, right in front of Mr. Bond, the policy prohibiting the possession or the consumption of alcohol on the premises was being violated, and ultimately Mr. Bond recommended to the board the termination of those two employees. And of course the board ultimately went along with that recommendation.
Now, were any of those facts in dispute for the jury to make a decision on?
Those facts were not in dispute.
What facts actually did the jury have to determine?
Well, I think the facts of the, not so much the facts of what had happened, what he caught them doing, but I think the facts of that the jury went on were other episodes, or at least alleged episodes, of drinking and possession of a beer on the premises.
Okay, so those were in dispute.
Those were in dispute.
He denied that he was drinking on the job. Is that right? I mean, wasn't that an issue? He had some excuse or explanation for why he actually wasn't working at the time he had this beer?
Well, he had an explanation of that they had worked through their breaks, through their lunch break, and his claim was that the time that this happened was minutes before 5:30 when they went off the clock at 5:25. So I guess from that standpoint, there was that dispute of almost probably 25 minutes as to when this happened.
And so the jury had to decide, first of all, whether or not he was drinking?
Well, I don't think the jury needed to decide that he was actually drinking, as long as it decided that he was in possession of alcoholic beverages on the premises. And the jury had to decide when it was, and then the jury went off, I think, and decided facts about how much there had been prior instances of drinking and possession of alcohol on the premises in the past.
Is it important how the beer got there and that it was owned by the company?
I don't think it's important to the discretion that was exercised by management, Justice. I think there was some question as to what extent, if any, Mr. Bond knew that the beer was there. But the point of the matter was that never before had he, as general manager, walked in and seen his employees, what he perceived to be 25 minutes or so before they clocked off, possessing beer on the premises and presumably drinking it or about to drink it. So at the trial, Cam Wall requested their proposed instruction number 16, which says, of course, that the jury's role is not one of de novo review, but rather it is one of assessing the objective reasonableness of Cam Wall's factual determination of misconduct. And as the instruction said in the last paragraph, if the jury found that the defendant had reasonable grounds to believe that sufficient cause existed to justify the termination of plaintiff's employment, then the verdict must be for the defendant.
Well, doesn't that eliminate then the contract language that says that there has to be exercised or cannot be exercised arbitrarily or unfairly? I mean, couldn't the jury say, yeah, I think he was. He had possession of beer. He clearly violated company rules. We don't accept the argument that there's a waiver. But they could still say, here's a guy who's been here for 30 years, and he's a good employee. He had one infraction, and it's arbitrary and unfair. And the contract says you can't be arbitrary. It's arbitrary and unfair just to fire the guy after all that time instead of giving him a warning or a demotion or something like that.
Well, I think the jury can make that determination in the context of the proposed instruction as well. What happened was, of course, the court refused the instruction, and the jury had every reason to believe that they had a blank check here, that they had full and unfettered discretion to do what they wanted, to step in.
It seems like that what this last sentence says, and now you tell me if I'm reading it incorrectly, all the jury has to say is, did the company believe that there was cause to fire him? Well, yes, they caught him with in possession of beer, and we believe he had beer, the jury says. Therefore, end of story. We don't even get to the arbitrary and unfair argument because the company says they believed that he broke the rules. You break the rules, you're gone.
I guess I respectfully disagree with that interpretation.
Show me where I'm wrong, because I want to hear you.
Sure. Justice, I think the key is sufficient cause, the word sufficient cause, sufficient under the circumstances. In other words, did the employer do a fair and a thorough investigation, make reasonable inquiry into the situation, and make a decision fairly and not unfairly and not arbitrarily.
But that's not what your proposed instruction says. The second to the last paragraph says that you are not required, talking to the jury, to determine whether in fact intoxicating liquor was used. Rather, it's your duty to determine if they were acting in good faith following an investigation and whether they had reasonable grounds for believing he had done so. So that's telling the jury, it doesn't matter whether he did it, you don't have to worry about arbitrary, capricious, you don't have to worry about waiver, estoppel. If there's a good faith belief, this paragraph is telling the jury that they must rule for the company.
Well, but looking at the instruction as a whole, the preceding paragraph, it talks about discharge for cause, which is one that's not for any arbitrary, capricious, or illegal reason, and one that's based on facts supported by substantial evidence and reasonably believed by the employer to be true. So taking the instruction as a whole, I think it's clear that it's consistent with the controlling contract here, the collective bargaining agreement, which says that it is in the province, it is in the exclusive province of the employer to, among other things, discipline or terminate or discharge employees.
Well, the court.
So long as it's not done arbitrarily or unfairly.
The court instructed that in instruction number 15. The court instructed that the customary functions of management and operation of business are vested exclusively with the employer, including the right to direct the workforce, et cetera. So they were given that part of the instruction.
Right. But our contention is that because of the refusal to give the proposed instruction, that the jury did not realize that they were not entitled to conduct a de novo review of the whole situation. By the failure to give that instruction, the jury had every reason to believe that it was fully within their rights and their duty to come in and second-guess management based on all the facts and the circumstances in the determination of the facts and in what should be done. As the Thompson Court from North Dakota says, and I'll quote, first of all, the court adopted the objective standard in the Cotran case regarding, and I quote, assessing an employer's decision about whether an employee actually committed the acts leading to discharge, and if so, whether the act constituted cause for termination. We believe that that is the standard that's appropriate. It's a standard that is apparently, from what we can tell, a majority view in this country, and it's a standard that makes sense and that should be adopted here. We believe that it's good law. Because
does the North Dakota case have a contract language like this collective bargaining agreement did, where they have this thing about arbitrary and unfair, can't be arbitrary and unfair?
It was a contract case, employment contract case. I don't recall offhand, Your Honor, if it made specific reference to arbitrariness or unfairness. The Thompson and Cotran rationale is good law that balances the employer's interest in making efficient decisions, such as efficient personnel decisions on the one hand, versus the employee's interest in maintaining employment. Businesses simply cannot make these personnel decisions consistent with their business needs and goals if they always have to worry about 1, 2, 3 years down the road being second-guessed in those decisions by a jury who can come in and look at it in a completely different context.
Mr. Casey, I think everybody would agree with that. The question here, though, is did you bargain away that right by your collective bargaining agreement? I mean, you have very specific terms here that aren't applicable, that aren't in those other cases that have applied that rule. It seems to me the argument is that you've perhaps bargained away the right to make that argument in this particular case. If you didn't have a collective bargaining agreement, those cases appear to apply directly.
Well, I guess I disagree respectfully, Justice, in that the collective bargaining agreement maintains in the employer the exclusive right to make that call, as long as they don't do it arbitrarily and capriciously, and there's nothing in the proposed instruction that's inconsistent with that. The way I read the proposed instruction, the jury has to look at this, not de novo, but look at the decision that was made, the factual determinations that were made, the decision that was made by management, the determination being that there was cause to terminate. The instruction says that the cause means that it cannot be arbitrary or illegal or anything of that sort. And I read the proposed instruction as being consistent with the agreement. And I don't read the agreement as contracting it away. I read the agreement as, again, maintaining that exclusive province to make that determination whether or not to terminate.
One last time. How do you reconcile the provision that says you must enforce the clause provisions, must do so not arbitrarily and capriciously, with the last paragraph of instruction 16, which simply says, if the defendant had reasonable cause to believe, then your verdict must be for the defendant? I mean, that's pretty plain. Isn't that that last sentence is clearly inconsistent with the collective bargaining agreement?
Well, again, I think the key word there is sufficient. That if the jury finds that the defendant had reasonable grounds to believe that sufficient cause existed to justify their termination, sufficient under the circumstances that they as they knew them to be, sufficient in terms of what they caught the defendants doing, sufficient in terms of what the other evidence indicated with respect to any prior possession or use of alcohol on the premises. And so I don't see that sentence takes away that right of the jury. I think the argument for the employee is that there wasn't sufficient cause to believe it because this had been allegedly allowed in the past without repercussions. But again, I think that this instruction, excuse me, I think that this collective bargaining agreement, the word exclusive means something, as does every word in the contract. And the word exclusive means this is our call. This is our call to make as an employer. And as long as we don't do it arbitrarily or unfairly, this is our call to make. And so a jury then has the right to come in and say, to come in and look at it, not de novo, but to look at the actions of the employer and say, was there an appropriate investigation? Was it done in good faith, the action taken against the employee in good faith? Was it appropriate under the circumstances, which is language in the instruction? And was there ultimately sufficient cause in existence to justify the termination of the plaintiff's employment?
Isn't instruction 15, though, cover some of that by instructing the jury that the management has exclusive, it's vested exclusively with the employer to determine these things?
Well,
what's wrong with instruction number 15? Because it does talk about these very things you're arguing.
I don't think it goes far enough. I think that it talks about, it basically recites that portion of the contract, but again, it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't put in context the jury's role in assessing what the employer did.
Now, you have said that your client was damaged by not, or prejudiced by not being allowed the instruction you wanted. Do you have any problems with the instructions that went to the jury, or are they simply incomplete?
I think they're incomplete.
Okay, so you're okay with what went into them, but that wasn't the whole pie. You're missing the crucial piece. Okay.
That's correct. So, again, the whole perspective of the jury was altered, I believe, by the failure to give this instruction. Because, again, the jury had every reason to believe, because that instruction wasn't given, that they could indeed be a Monday morning quarterback. They could indeed come in and second-guess management and do what they thought was fair, what they thought was right, what they think they would have done under those circumstances. And I don't believe that is a proper role of the jury in a case like this involving a contract and a for-cause provision. So we would ask that this case be remanded, reversed and remanded with instructions to give instruction number 16. Unless there are other questions, my yellow light is on and I will sit down.
Thank you. Mr. Clayton, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, good morning. I do represent Roger Vedder. Just briefly talking about the facts, I don't need to tell the Supreme Court what its rules are as far as reviewing so-called disputed evidence in a case. Camwall did not argue that there was not enough evidence to support the verdict. Instead, they're focusing on this jury instruction number 16, and I would tell you, you know, the jury agreed with Roger Vedder on every fact, and that's why Roger Vedder got the verdict he did. It didn't agree with Jeff Bond's timeline of 5:05 as the time that it happened.
How do you know that?
Because the facts showed that Jeff Bond drove into Camwall at 5:05. The facts showed it took him a minute to walk to his office. The facts showed
what the jury, we don't know what the jury, we, the jury could well have thought he was drinking on the job and well into the job, but we still think that the company's decision was arbitrary. Couldn't they do that?
I don't believe so, because there was no evidence that stated that Roger Vedder at that afternoon had drank any of the beer at the time Jeff Bond saw him. There's no evidence from Camwall that said he did. And Jeff and Roger Vedder testified he didn't, and Sean Schmidt testified that he didn't, and neither did Roger Vedder. Okay? There might have been some issues about the jury not agreeing with all of Roger Vedder's facts. At this stage, we have to accept all of those facts as having been decided in Roger Vedder's favor. What I would like to do is just really focus on this jury instruction number 16 that comes from California and has now been transferred over to North Dakota. If the court agrees that instruction number 16 should have been applied in this case or in future cases, it's going to represent a sea change in the way wrongful termination cases are decided in South Dakota. Okay. First of all, Cotran and Thompson, on their facts, don't even apply to Roger Vedder's case. As you were questioning Mr. Casey, there's a clear collective bargaining agreement here which states that the employer's decisions cannot be exercised arbitrarily or unfavorably to any employee. And it says, shall not be, okay? Cotran dealt with an implied contract of employment. Matter of fact, the Supreme Court justices in California didn't even agree that there was an implied contract and sent it down as part of their instructions to decide whether there is an implied contract. And then since, assuming that it was, the Supreme Court in California did state, okay, if the jurors are gonna, you know, look at this case, then the way they should look at it is, you know, give the employer this discretion for these reasons. And the Supreme Court there, I believe, allowed the facts or the decision that resulted in the proposed instruction number 16, because in that implied contract, there was no discussion or agreement as to what the employer's role was as far as how it exercises its right to terminate an employee for cause. Okay. Now you get to Thompson. And Thompson, again, there is something in writing, okay? But there's nothing in it like the collective bargaining agreement that says the employer cannot exercise its rights to terminate or discipline an employee in an arbitrary or unfair manner. That's exactly what this contract says in Vedder. Now, Justice Zinter, you were correct. They can bargain for that in the next round to include all these terms if they want to, and the union can decide which terms they can live with or not. But the collective bargaining agreement is what it is and what it was at the time of this trial. Now, if Camwall wants to go back and add more discretion to itself, it should be allowed to. And when you look at the collective bargaining agreement, who else but a jury would decide whether this exclusive right to discipline or terminate an employee is arbitrary or unfair.
But don't you think the larger sense, Cotran's principle has some, makes sense. Do we really want courts and juries to micromanage American business so that business judgment is now being overseen and supervised by juries and judges? That wouldn't be appropriate, would it? I mean, what's wrong with having the jury told, look, the employer made they investigated it, they looked at these facts, they weren't unreasonable in making the determination that this man was drinking. After all, he's sitting at the desk, company desk, on company time, he's a beer in front of him. Why should we have the jury second-guessing that?
Well, I would state, and I believe that the Cotran decision was decided on just wrong policy reasons, okay? One of the
reasons... You take issue with the whole idea that juries shouldn't be micromanaging American business. You believe that that's... Maybe I'm using the wrong words that you wouldn't agree with, but you do agree that the final decision in any management decision should be the jury's decision.
Well, I understand your point, but this is what the Cotran and Thompson court said about the jury's role. It said, equally significant is the jury's relative remoteness from the everyday reality of the workplace. Now, let's think about that. Just about every jury I have is comprised of people who work and have worked for a long time. I even have HR people come to sit on the jury panel. Okay? They know what goes on in the workplace. It's rare that you see jurors who don't know what goes on in the workplace. You, as judges, have presided over cases and listened to jury selection and know for yourselves that most jurors are comprised of people who have been in the workplace and most likely been in the workplace for a long time. They know what happens. And further, what happens in a workplace is not a complicated situation.
Isn't that a generalization? I mean, we can talk about people who, work in one industry, but they won't know anything about another industry. You can be a farmer and have no knowledge of how mines are run and how they should be managed.
Okay. Let's talk about other cases. Now, what happens about product liability cases where you have extremely difficult and complicated facts? What do we do there? Do we then say, well, a jury is, relatively removed from knowing about how machines operate, therefore we shouldn't allow them to make a decision in a products liability case? Take a Vioxx case. What do we say there where you have scientists arguing back and forth? Now, to me, those cases would be much more complicated and difficult for a jury to decide than what happens in a workplace. And even if you think about it further, Justice Konenkamp, people who are really close to facts involved in cases are usually excused for cause or by peremptory challenges. You want a neutral jury, not someone who may have been in a product liability dispute or accident before or took Vioxx and is now, being questioned about whether he should be on the stand. You want that neutral, perhaps removed jury. And the next thing that the Cotran case hangs its hat on is there's a fast-paced business atmosphere, and we just can't stop the tracks to decide an employee's future. Okay, I take exception to that because we're not talking about widgets on an assembly line. We're not talking about decisions to invest money in technology or research. We're talking about decisions that involve an employee, okay? And human nature doesn't change. And for the most part, and even in this case, there was a history between Jeff Bond and Terry Keller, management, and Roger Vedder.
Did you argue to the jury that the companies, the way they procedurally handled this was arbitrary or simply the decision to fire your client, or both?
It was certainly both. No one had been disciplined to date, in at least 19 or 20 years for drinking.
Right, that's the bottom line, and I understand that you feel to be arbitrary, but the fact he was called in, I believe, next week, and he was talked to by the attorney for the co-op and the co-op's general manager. Do you have a problem with that, too?
That they talked to him?
Well, I'm trying to find out what's arbitrary here. Just the decision to fire your client or the whole way it was handled?
Well, first of all, there was no investigation, okay? If there had been an investigation, what would have come out of that investigation is what came out in trial, that drinking on the premises was a commonplace occurrence. It took place before the 5:30 bell rang. And even Jeff Bond had to look at himself in the mirror and realize that he had drank on Camwall premises. And as management, he was on the clock when he was there drinking and playing buck euchre with the linemen. Terry Keller even admitted it, and other linemen testified to it as well. There was no investigation whatsoever about Jeff Bond's decision to recommend termination of Roger Vedder.
So even under the proposed instruction, your client would win because the jury would then determine, if you're arguing that, if I'm understanding it, is that the defendants weren't acting in good faith or following an investigation that was appropriate under the circumstances.
And I believe that my client would have won even, well, in my opinion, he should win given that instruction, but I still believe it would have been the wrong instruction to give because, first of all, it wasn't supported by any facts or competent evidence. But even besides that, I don't want the Supreme Court to consider this instruction as something that could have or should have been proper in this circumstance or circumstances going forward. And if you look at Toussaint versus Blue Cross, which is the Michigan case, which our Supreme Court has cited 3 or 4 times, it's cited in Butterfield. That case talked about employee handbooks, which could constitute a contract of employment. If they were so thorough that it showed that the employer had given away its right to terminate an employee for cause. Okay. Now, if you go back and say, well, this instruction is good for cases going forward, you have a situation where the decision may just be totally wrong, okay? But it may have some kind of basis in believability, all right, that would convince a jury that the employer at least tried to do the right thing. I think that it shouldn't be the law going forward in this case. It's not the law in South Dakota now, and I don't believe it should be the law going forward. I represent employers too, and I know when we go, and I just had a meeting with an employer about terminating a couple employees, and we accumulated facts. We had a hearing. We dotted the T's and crossed the I's, and we'll stand by the decision that was made, okay? Why can't other employers here in South Dakota do the same thing, okay? Why can't they come up with the right decision? Because we're not talking about fast-paced widgets on an assembly line. We're talking about people's careers. And if they're a for-cause employee, they're most likely middle-aged management and probably the toughest to get re-employment.
And you're not making a distinction between employees with or without contracts?
Well, I am. If you don't have a contract, you're an at-will employee, and this doesn't apply.
I didn't hear you making that distinction in your argument.
Oh, yeah. This is an at-will.
It sounded to me like you were making a fair play argument as opposed to a contractual or an employment argument.
Okay. This is an at-will state.
I understand.
I totally concede that. And yeah, and don't argue against it. So when you put it all together, I think if you stated that this instruction should have applied to this case, and we can all talk about judicial activism, we can all talk about, you know, should a jury should a judge try to change the law as it goes, and I think people argue that both sides or the other. people think it's good sometimes, people think it's bad sometimes, but I believe that if you grafted that language from COTRAN into this case, it would be adding terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement that was already negotiated and agreed to by Cam Wall. And I would ask you not to do that. I don't believe COTRAN and Thompson, by the way, Thompson did, there was a written contract, but it didn't have any arbitrary or unfair language.
There was none in COTRAN.
And there was none in COTRAN either, absolutely not. So I guess the jury in this case did not have unfettered discretion, as Mr. Casey argued. The jury had its set of jury instructions given to them by Judge Lovren, which included instruction number 15, which stated that the employer had the exclusive right to determine the conditions of employment. And it included instruction number 16, which stated that the limit of that was that the employer could not act arbitrarily or unfairly. The language was taken directly from the collective bargaining agreement. It was accurate, it was fair, it was fair to both sides. The jury did not have unfettered discretion to do whatever it wanted to, and I would ask you to deny the appellant's appeal and rule that instruction number 16 was properly refused.
I haven't had a chance to read the record yet. Did you make that same argument in resistance to instruction 16 as you're making to this court?
You know, I didn't have to argue very much. Judge Lovren actually was the one that was putting Mr. Casey on the hot seat as far as the appropriateness of this instruction.
Did you object to it?
Oh, yes.
So you objected, you just didn't have to argue?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Nobody's ever chastised for quitting early. Thank you, Mr. Clayton. And Mr. Casey, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor, and hopefully I will be brief, as I don't care to repeat myself, and I'm sure you don't want me to as well. But I would say that in response to a couple of comments that Mr. Clayton made, he talked about jurors in the workplace and everybody's got, you know, some experience in the workplace, and that's largely true. But the purpose of this rule that's embodied in the instruction is to give deference to management in running its business consistent with its needs and its goals. And as it applied to this case in particular, it's a great example of that. I mean, here we have two linemen, the only two linemen that are on duty. These are the go-to guys. If something happens and there's an outage, what are they going to do? They're going to get in their truck and they're going to drive Cam Wall's truck to the location, a rural location at that. They're going to be working with a very dangerous commodity, electricity. And so when the general manager comes upon this situation and he sees what's going on, he's thinking, wait a minute, these guys are the people I've got to rely on. And so he does a deliberate job of making sure that they were in fact on duty. He does a deliberate job of calling in the board's counsel and helping him in interviewing these individuals. Mr. Clayton can say that there was no investigation, but that's flat wrong. There was an investigation by talking to these two individuals separately between Mr. Bond and the corporate counsel, and finding out that yes, indeed, they were drinking on the job. And he, Mr. Bond, as a general manager, seeing this for the first and only time in his position of running this co-op, makes a determination that he should recommend to the board their termination. He's putting his foot down. He's drawing a line in the sand. And he's saying, I can't tolerate this. Under these facts and circumstances, I can't tolerate this. The message that it sends to other employees, is that this is okay. And if he doesn't draw that line in the sand the first time, when does he have a right to draw the line in the sand? And is a jury always entitled to come in and draw that line for business?
But the difference here, Mr. Casey, and the question I have is, this is tried as a contract case and a breach of contract case. In these instructions, court reflects the language of the contract. Aren't you, by this request for an additional instruction and the wording of your instruction, aren't you adding language to the contract of the parties by what you're requesting this court to consider here? In other words, this is tried as a contract case. This isn't some kind of other public policy or law that covers employees. So aren't you attempting by this introduction of this instruction to actually add language to the contract?
I don't believe so. And the reason I don't believe so is, again, I believe that the instruction is totally consistent with the substance of everything that's in the collective bargaining agreement, in that it gives deference, as does the provision of the agreement itself, to management to make this decision. And the instruction says, in the four corners of it, that this cause, just cause, reason for termination cannot be an arbitrary one. And that there's nothing in the terms of the instruction that expand what is in the contract. I think they're consistent. But what it does do is it changes, it frames the perspective for a jury as to how they should look at this case, that they can't come in and second-guess management and just say, well, you know, we wouldn't do that way if we were management.
But now instruction 16 that was given does include the cannot be exercised arbitrarily or unfairly to any employee. So that's already covered.
That is covered. What isn't covered is the role of the jury. And that's the whole essence of our proposed instruction, is what is the role of the jury in assessing the objective reasonableness of management in making the call that it made, given their exclusive province to do so under the agreement, given their need to carry out their needs as a business, their goals as a business. What is the essential function of the jury? That is the single item that was missing from the instructions. That is the whole sum and substance, as I see it, of our proposed instruction 16 that was denied. And had that been given, at least we would have been able to argue that the jury can't just Monday morning quarterback this decision that was made. The jury can't just come in and say, I wouldn't have done it that way. I mean, we can all have our own opinions as to whether we would have done it that way, but that's not the question, or that shouldn't be the question. The question should be, was there objective reasonableness in management doing what it did under the circumstances? And the jury has the right to look at it with that instruction, frame the issue that way, and make the same determination that they did. But they can't do it from the standpoint of having a blank check to come in and do what they darn well pleased and substitute their judgment for that of management.
Mr. Casey, let me ask you about prejudice and whether you've established it, because you did not object to waiver and estoppel theories. How do we know, and we've got to sustain the verdict if there's any rational theory that supports the jury verdict. How do we know the jury didn't decide this case purely on waiver or estoppel?
Well, we don't, but I believe that there is prejudice in the fact that this instruction wasn't given, so the jury had the right to, there wasn't anything wrong per se in the waiver and estoppel instructions. Those are pattern instructions. But But the jury, given the instructions they were given, felt that they could do what they darn well pleased. And that's where the prejudice comes, because we couldn't argue that that is not the case. We couldn't argue that, the jury was not free to substitute its judgment for that of management. And therein lies the prejudice to us. And of course, the only way to find out whether the jury would arrive at the same decision is to reverse and remand and let us go at it again with the jury properly instructed as to this body of law that their role is to assess objective reasonableness. There are no other questions. Okay. I have no other comments. Thank you, Court.
Thank you, Mr. Casey. For those who are returning for the next argument, we'll have to run on a fairly tight schedule this morning because two of the justices have to be up in the Senate and the House chambers to swear those bodies in at 12 noon. So we'll be in recess for 10 minutes and start promptly thereafter. We're in recess.